This is the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're online at jeffexchange.org and ijpr.org, and you can find not only interviews dating back nearly 6 years on the Jefferson Exchange at those sites. You can also use them to listen live to this or any program on any of the three services of Jefferson Public Radio. The Exchange is also on social media. We have a Facebook site. We also are at Twitter, at Jeff Exchange. And you can take part in the program as it happens. We're about to have another live interview, and this is the chance for you to call in and weigh in on the topic at hand. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Bees have lots of fans, it turns out. Over the last few years, as stories about bee populations declining hit the news, people realized how important bees are to life around us. Bumblebees in particular face challenges, including one that may be extinct already in the Siskiyous. I mean, the bee, not the challenge, which is why there is a Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas. We revisit the topic after a year with Rich Hatfield, the senior conservation biologist at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Hi, Rich. Rich, you there?
Yeah, good morning.
There we go. Okay. Pepper Trail's in the studio with me as well, senior forensic scientist and ornithologist at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Laboratory in Ashland. Pepper, always good to see you.
Morning.
Rich, start us off. We visited with you about a year ago about the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas, and give us the general stuff on bumblebees and the concerns about them.
Yeah, well, there's about 50 species in North America, and a few years ago, I and a group of scientists across North America basically analyzed the extinction risk for all of those species. And what we found is that around a quarter of North America's bumblebees were facing some degree of extinction risk. And we had land managers from sort of all over the country coming to us looking for recommendations about how to create habitat for these animals to improve the situation so that we could help some of these imperiled species recover. And when we dove into the database, we realized that we just didn't really have enough information to give great evidence-based recommendations. And so one of the ideas we had to solve that problem was to launch this Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas, where we could get people out all over the Pacific Northwest gathering information so that we can find where these animals are living, what plants they're using, what habitats are important, what habitat features are important, so that then we can gather up a bunch of evidence that we can provide to organizations like the Forest Service, the BLM, the Park Service, the State of Oregon, and help them to develop evidence-based management guidelines to protect and conserve our important pollinating bumblebees.
With the quarter of the 50 species, you say, facing some risk of extinction, are any listed, are any protected as threatened or endangered species, either federally or by states?
Yeah. So in a couple of years ago, we petitioned the rusty patch bumblebee, Bombus affinis, to be protected as an endangered species, and it was officially listed in 2017. On the Endangered Species Act. But that species is native from North Dakota to Georgia, sort of down and then up through Maine, sort of that corner of the country, the eastern, northeastern portion. There's several other species that have been petitioned for endangered species listing. One of them is Bombus franklini, which you mentioned in your introduction there, Franklin's bumblebee. That species actually hasn't been seen since 2006, despite repeated efforts to find it. And that petition is pending at the Fish and Wildlife Service office. And then there's two other species that have been petitioned, the yellow-banded bumblebee, Bombus tericola, and the western bumblebee, Bombus occidentalis, which is another animal that is a focus of the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas. It's used to be quite common throughout our region and has disappeared most dramatically sort of west of the Cascade Sierra Crest.
And if people aren't picking up on the taxonomy, Bombus is the genus for bumblebees, right?
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, sometimes it's hard to mix. There aren't really great common names for some of these animals, so sometimes I forgot to share them. So I appreciate you reminding me.
No, I'm glad to hear the Latin names as well. Pepper Trail is finding a Franklin's bumblebee, something like the search for the Holy Grail in Southern Oregon?
Yeah, that's a good description. It's been an object of great fascination, almost obsession for some of us local bumblebee lovers here in Southern Oregon, because it is such a unique species. It had the narrowest range of all the world's bumblebees, as far as we know, just found in a small area of the Siskiyous. And So we had a lot of pride in it, and when it began to disappear, it was cause of great concern. And as Rich said, it hasn't been seen since 2006, despite the searches of many people, including myself. Most recently, just a couple of weeks ago, a team was up around Mount Ashland searching for it, but sadly to no avail again.
You mentioned a particular place in the Siskiyou. Mount Ashland is that particular place, right? That's the general
environment? That's the place it was last captured, where it was last seen. Those of you who know Mount Ashland know that behind to the west, there's a beautiful wildflower-filled area called Grouse Gap, and that's an area where many people go to admire the wildflowers and where you can see lots of bumblebees, and one of the places that we search. That's not the only place that we search and the only place that it was found, but that's been the focus of a lot of efforts.
Rich Hatfield, how do the bumblebees differ from the honeybees?
The main difference is that they don't make honey. and none of our native bees make honey. They have somewhat a similar sort of colony structure in that they have a queen like a honeybee does, and they have workers like a honeybee colony would, and they have males or drones like a honeybee colony would. But honeybees have what we call a perennial life cycle. So they actually make honey during the summertime so that they can have food to eat during the wintertime when there are no flowers in bloom. And bumblebees have a different strategy for surviving the winter. Instead of sort of building up food reserves throughout the summer, they actually hibernate. So at the end of the summer, when the reproductive members of the colony have mated, the new queens will actually hibernate, you know, just a couple inches under the surface of the ground, and the rest of the colony, including the founder's queen, dies off. So they have an annual life cycle. They only live for 1 year as opposed to several years like a honeybee colony might.
We're talking about the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas with Rich Hatfield, senior conservation biologist for the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. He's on the phone. Pepper Trail is from the Rogue Valley, forensic scientist and ornithologist at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Laboratory in Ashland. He's helped, obviously, compile some information for the Bumblebee Atlas. Questions, comments, welcome on the Jefferson Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Rich, in the year since we last talked to you, I noticed it was late July. How much bigger has the Atlas grown? How much more do you know about bumblebees around the Northwest?
A lot. We've gotten really a tremendous response. It's been very heartening to see how many people have taken this project on in earnest and dedicated countless hours to this project. So over the last 2 years, sort of 2018 through basically August 1st, we've had over 900 people submit bumblebee observations throughout the three-state area, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and they've submitted almost 10,000 bumblebee records throughout those areas. So it's really been a tremendous response. We've gotten a lot of great information. I haven't had a lot of time in the office to process the data from 2019 yet, but we learned a lot in 2018 alone.
And Pepper Trail, as you've taken part in the field work here, what do you have to do?
Well, it's a pretty strict protocol. There's a couple different ways you can do it. There are surveys, which are in a defined area that you have 45 minutes to search to try to catch as many bumblebees as you can. Within that area, 100 meters by 100 meters. You then chill them down. You carry a little, picnic cooler with you with some ice in it. And after you capture the bumblebees, you put them in vials and you put them in the cooler to chill them so they aren't quite so frisky. And then you identify them and photograph them so that Rich and other experts can actually verify that your identifications are correct, because some of these species are very similar in appearance and quite a challenge to identify. And then you release them, of course, once they're warmed up again. And you record a lot of information about the site. So you record all of the flowers that are present, all of the flowers that you catch the bees feeding on, and other environmental variables like what the weather is and whether there's evidence of grazing, whether there's evidence of recent fires, for example, all those kinds of environmental variables. And there are also roadside surveys. In addition to those fixed plot surveys, you can survey along roads if that's the most convenient way to access flowering.
So for each finding of bees, you got a whole long list of other factors that you're cataloging along with that bee.
Right, and you photograph every bee. So I recently did a couple of surveys, and I think I ended up probably over 1,000 photographs.
Wow. Now,
for each bee, you're supposed to submit the three best photographs mm-hmm. for them to identify. So for one bee, I might take, 10 pictures because they're not always quite as chilled as you might wish, and they can be pretty hard to get a good picture of. So just culling down all that information, it takes a while, but it's great to know that you're contributing to a really important database.
You can get stung by these bees, can't you?
You can, and I have. they're very slow to anger. Unlike honeybees, they are pretty docile. But if you're careless, you can get stung. And sometimes, and males, as in honeybees, don't have stingers. And sometimes you can conclude that you've got a male, and you confidently grab it, and it turns out that you are mistaken, and it's a female, and it stings you. So, yeah, Rich is laughing. It's happened to him, I'm sure. So it's not a, at least for me personally, I don't get a reaction to it, but the sting itself is pretty painful.
Yeah, I got stung by yellow jackets recently. I was reminded, ouch, that really does hurt, no reaction, but still, ow, So, Rich, you mentioned that you hadn't had a chance to look at the data in real depth, but are you at least in a preliminary glance getting some ideas about things you're learning about bumblebees that you might not have known before?
Yeah, I mean, we're finding some important distribution information. There's a really common bumblebee in your part of the world, as well as throughout much of the Pacific Northwest, called the Voznesensky or yellow-faced bumblebee. And it's typically been found sort of in the western half of our region, but we found the first records from the state of Idaho from this. So that's a big expansion east for that species. And we've also found a lot of records of this western bumblebee that that we're so concerned about. So last year we found, I think, close to 150 records of that species throughout the region. And, from that information, we're learning a lot about what flowers it's using on the landscape, as well as Pepper mentioned, all of the habitat features associated with those observations. They can really help us, when we dive deeper, help us to create some really good recommendations for landowners and land managers about what they can do to improve habitat, to encourage the western bumblebee, to rehabitate the portion of its range that it's been lost from.
Rich Hatfield and Pepper Trail, our guests on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas. Your questions and comments, welcome at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Becca in Lane County writes, what's the best way to ID an insect to Xerces Society? A couple of weeks ago, I saw a bee, wasp, beetle thing that I've never seen in my 20 years in Oregon. I haven't been able to find it via internet searches.
To be honest, at the Xerces Society, we don't really have the capacity to handle, many identification emails. We get a lot of them, and we try to respond when we can. For bumblebees, the best thing to do is to submit to bumblebeewatch.org, which is our community science project where we're collecting the information from the Bumblebee Atlas project. For all other insects, I'll recommend a reference called Bug Guide, which is a website that's run largely by a taxonomist by the name of John Asher. And he's really phenomenal at giving feedback to people and can give IDs on more insects than I possibly could imagine. So I would recommend that as a great identification resource. Right, or so, non-bumblebees.
Yeah, I hear what Becca's talking about, though, because I to this day, I'm not quite sure yellow jacket is a wasp, not a bee. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right, so these are the things we have to keep in mind as we go through. So talk about, Rich, you probably have a lot of areas that you need to still have covered, grids that people need to adopt for the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas.
Yeah, that's right. So what we've done to try to cover the whole area is we've broken up each state into equal area grids. They're approximately 50 kilometers by 50 kilometers, and part of the impetus for this project at the beginning is that, the bumblebee observation map that we were getting was starting to look a lot like a human population density map. We were getting observations of bumblebees where people were living. And, you know, we need to get information there, but also out in the more remote rural areas of the states, because Oregon, Washington, and Idaho are so large and wild in many places. And so we've done a pretty good job covering a lot of those rural areas. Almost the entire state of Washington has been adopted and surveyed at this point. But in Oregon, there's still quite a bit of work to do. Actually, east of Ashland in the Lakeview area, there's a few grid cells that haven't been adopted. And then sort of between there and Steens Mountain, there's a large portion of area that hasn't been surveyed. And it's probably not great habitat for bumblebees. There may not be tons of them out there, but they're pretty ubiquitous. And I would say certainly in some of the riparian draws and other areas out there in the sagebrush steppe, you're very likely to encounter some of these animals. And those are really important areas to survey, and we're hoping to get a little bit more participation in that area.
Pepper Trail, how often are you supposed to go out, and how long does each excursion take for your adopted grid cell?
They would like you to do two surveys at least in each grid cell that you adopt. Mm-hmm. The time period is from June through into September, but you know, July and August are sort of the prime times for flowering for a lot of these species. So that's kind of the minimum commitment that they ask you to provide, right?
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned it's fairly intensive work. So how long will you spend on a particular day that you've devoted to collecting information for the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas?
Well, you can do two survey sites in a day. Mm-hmm. Following up on what Rich said, my grid area that I've adopted is out in eastern Oregon on the east side in the Summer Lake area, because I visit out there fairly often. And so I don't make a special trip. I do it when I'm out there for my other reasons, and I can do two surveys in a day to do the surveys. And then actually compiling the data, going through all the photos, that takes more time. But that's about all you can do. And then, you know, perhaps a roadside survey as well.
Okay. 1,000 photos, though, with the three best ones needed to be submitted.
It's, your eyes cross after
a
while.
Thank goodness we're not using film anymore. So, yep. Pepper, I know we have many talents contained in the mind of Pepper Trail here, and you brought some verse that you wrote in here, or blank verse anyway.
Well, yeah, I really love bumblebees. And so I wrote a little, as I was surveying a couple years ago, I wrote a little tribute to them on Mount Ashland, just encapsulating my affection for them. The bumblebee, squat and hairy bagman, trundles around her neighborhood, one flower to the nearby next, filling her sacks with gold, humming to herself all the while. On a fine summer day, there is no more self-satisfied citizen on the mountain.
All right. A little bit of verse from Pepper Trail to help us appreciate bumblebees. Rich Hatfield, Senior Conservation Biologist for the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Easiest way to contact you about the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas?
Probably just to email me. My email is rich.hatfield@xerces.org.
All righty. And Pepper Trail, as always, good to see you from the Fish and Wildlife Forensics Lab in Ashland.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you can check out the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas online. We provide a link to it at our website, jeffexchange.org. That'll do it for this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. More coming up in hour number two with restaurants and music. Stay tuned.